New England governors have begun their 2022 re-election campaigns. But in Massachusetts, the political world is still waiting on incumbent Governor Charlie Baker. That's just one of the topics we'll be delving into on And Another Thing today as we look back on some of the week's news. Pierre Kennedy is off today. I'm Maya Schwader. Also ahead, a look at what New England states might do with some of the infrastructure money coming their way. Should we fix bridges and roads? Should we build the East-West Rail? Could we do all of the above? And the verdict came down in the first of several trials stemming from a fight involving off-duty Springfield police officers outside a city bar. Our panel today, welcome to Chris Collins, contributing editor of FranklinCountyNow.com.
Hello.
Back again with us is Holyoke Media News Director Natalia Munoz. Thanks as always for being here, Natalia.
Thank you for inviting me.
And we have Berkshire Eagle Investigations Editor Larry Parnas.
Hey, Maya. Hey, everybody.
This week, two New England governors said that they are launching their re-election campaigns. New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu had been under pressure from Republicans to consider a run for U.S. Senate. But he says he believes he can accomplish more in his current office.
And I'd rather push myself 120 miles an hour delivering wins for New Hampshire than to slow down, end up on Capitol Hill debating partisan politics without results. That's why I'm going to run for a fourth term. And I'd be honored if the people of New Hampshire would elect me again as their governor.
In Connecticut, Democrat Ned Lamont made it clear he wants another 4 years as governor.
I think the state made extraordinary progress over the last 3 years. We had moving vans leaving the state, businesses leaving the state, people being a little bit down on the state. And I think 3 years later, the moving vans have turned around. Businesses are coming back to the state.
And the one we're still waiting to hear from, Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker. So far, nothing but a loud silence. So panel, first off, we are still before Thanksgiving. The election is a little more than a year away. Sununu and Lamont are beginning their campaigns, however. Does either of them face any kind of significant primary challenge that we know of?
Chris, do you have thoughts?
I know that money is not going to be an issue for him because the guy financed his own campaign the last time around. I mean, it comes down to whether or not the Republicans, like in Massachusetts, have a candidate that can appeal across the aisle. I mean, Baker's success in Massachusetts has been that he's largely a centrist and that he's not viewed as threatening to a very blue state. I don't know that there's such an animal exists in Connecticut or not. From what I understand, a lot of the Republican candidates are pretty conservative, pretty extreme. So I think it comes down to if Lamont faces a challenge or a challenger that has wide cross appeal, he's going to have a problem. 50% is not a great approval rating for a guy who's been in office for 4 years, even in a pandemic. I mean, no incumbent is real popular right now because some people are upset about the way things have been handled because of COVID. But if the Republicans can come across with somebody who's palatable to both sides, Lamont could be in trouble.
And speaking of incumbents, of course, all of us here in Massachusetts are waiting with bated breath to hear what Charlie Baker is going to do. So far, we have, I believe, at least three people who have launched Democratic tickets. The only Republican so far to launch a campaign has been Jeff Diehl, who flanks Charlie Baker quite to the right. Could it be perhaps that the GOP doesn't want Baker to run? Could it be that he has gone too far to the center for them? Natalia, do you have thoughts?
Yeah, I don't think that the GOP is telling Baker what to do, which foot goes first. Baker is his own man. The GOP has got nothing on him. He has always been an independent governor from the GOP that became Trump's GOP.
Chris, you had a thought.
Yeah, Diehl's not going anywhere. I mean, a Trump Republican's not going to win in Massachusetts, you know, unless all the Democrats leave. One of the realities that Baker has been operating under, as has any Republican governor, is that the real power in Massachusetts lies in the legislature. They have a Democratic supermajority. They can do what they want. They don't necessarily need to have a Republican governor's approval to do much of anything. So Baker's played that game very, very well. The Republicans in Massachusetts are in such disarray, they would be really stupid to push a guy like that out of there. I mean, you're not going to find a Republican who is as Democrat-friendly as Baker has been. He's been pretty successful getting a pretty good agenda passed, and the same cannot be said for the Republicans in the legislature. We haven't got enough people to field a good softball team. So if they dump Baker, that's a really stupid move, I think.
Meantime, we haven't yet mentioned Lieutenant Governor Karen Pulido, who is takes pride in having been to all 351 cities and towns in Massachusetts. She, according to a recent back-of-the-envelope Politico analysis, her travel schedule and appearance schedule is twice that of Baker in recent weeks. I think this wait here, which Baker likes to call insatiable curiosity of the news media, could be waiting to see whether Maura Healey, the attorney general, is going to go into the race. I see, if you look at her calendar, I see a lot of appearances that are a little less attorney general-ish and more sounding like a general candidate kind of appearance. So I think this could be just a strategic delay here, and maybe just to annoy the people who annoy the governor.
I want to turn for a moment back to local politics. On Monday, Joshua Garcia is taking the oath of office as the new mayor of Holyoke. He is the first Latino mayor for that majority Latinx city. There has been a lot of press attention paid to his Puerto Rican heritage. He, however, ran much more on his managerial experience, and he's talked about wanting to make city management improvements his top priority. Natalia, as our most beloved and today token Hispanic representative on the panel today, what is your reaction to him somewhat downplaying his identity during the campaign?
Well, we've seen where identity politics has taken this country. Identity politics can sometimes be dangerous. I don't think that's what's happening with Joshua Garcia. I just think that Joshua, born and raised in Holyoke, son of a Puerto Rican mother, he's Puerto Rican too, obviously, he's playing up his strong suit to be a manager of a city, which is his managerial credentials, which are pretty good, actually, very good.
Do you expect that identity is going to define him as a mayor, or do you expect that he might be just constantly trying to get away from it?
I don't think he's constantly trying to get away from his identity. I think he's just really telling the media, look, I'm a manager of municipalities. Yes, I'm Puerto Rican, but that's not the thing that's going to drive my decisions as mayor of Holyoke. What's going to drive my decisions as mayor of Holyoke, Joshua Garcia said, is what is best for Holyoke.
I'm wondering, since it seems like identity politics are not going away anytime soon, should it be part of the equation, or are we hoping to get to a point where it really doesn't matter and it is never brought up, no matter what the candidate looks like?
I think that's a good theory, Maya. But if you look back even a century and longer, ethnic identity in elections has always been played a role. And I don't think it has to be seen as a negative thing, because there's such strength and community purpose in identity. And I also think because of the push over political ends and national politics, I think it's just with us for some time to come.
Yeah, I
Chris,
agree
your
with
thoughts?
That. I also think that there's an old saying that you campaign in poetry and you govern in prose. The thing I found interesting about the Holyoke mayor's race is the winning candidate campaigned in prose. Whether it's a town the size of Montgomery or a city the size of Holyoke, the mechanics of running a community are largely the same. It's just a question of size. I was surprised. I thought Mike Solomon would run away with that only because he's been on the city council for a while. But I think the voters in Holyoke took a look at the two candidates. I don't think it was about ethnics. I think it was about who is best qualified for the job. He's got the ability, the moxie, and, I don't think it was about the color of his skin so much as the content of his ability as a manager that got him the job.
You're listening to the Friday Week in Review here on And Another Thing. Our panelists today are Holyoke Media News Director Natalia Munoz, Berkshire Eagle Investigations Editor Larry Parnas, and FranklinCounty.com Contributing Editor Chris Collins. Since we're speaking about how to run a city, we have this new $1 trillion infrastructure bill. All the New England states are beginning to chomp at the bit, making early plans, talking about how these federal dollars are going to be spent. Connecticut Congressman John Larson has said that he expects at least $6 billion will be coming to his state. He said that he hopes much of it will be spent on road and bridge repairs.
President Biden must have had Connecticut in mind when he put forward this initiative to make sure that displaced communities and communities that would otherwise be isolated, like North Hartford, are now reconnected to the city, are now reconnected to their riverfront.
And in Massachusetts, Congressman Richard Neal of Springfield, he chairs the House Ways and Means Committee, he said that he expects the state to see about $12 billion. Neal is pushing for some of that money to fund a passenger rail service in this part of the state.
I've had a series of meetings with the governor encouraging him on that basis. And now it is likely that that money in terms of cash flow will be available.
So $12 billion, that's a lot of money. How much do we think is going to be spent fixing longstanding recurring problems rather than dedicating the money to new projects like the fabled East-West Rail?
It's a fable, is it? we're so used to throwing out these big numbers now ever since, March of 2020. Early on in the discussions of East-West Rail, the idea that this would be a $1 billion project just sort of silenced people at these public hearings and meetings on this. But now it's actually possible. There was talk then of a generational investment, but there was no idea of how that money would be found. And yet here we are 2 years later with a lot of money flowing from our grandchildren's pockets into these kinds of investments here. So I think someone might really press to have the East-West Rail project be realized. If it doesn't get all the way to Pittsfield, there's going to be a lot of unhappy people in Berkshire County.
I have to just say, I understand that people want to be able to get on a train, you know, in the western part of the state and end up in Boston. That's a nice theory, but you may as well take that money and flush it down the toilet if this is what you're going to spend it on. We've got crumbling roads, crumbling bridges. We're lucky some of these bridges haven't collapsed. I personally, right now, we're waiting for 2 years for a bridge here in Turner's Falls to be fixed, which has been neglected for the better part of 20 years. The whole idea of building back better was supposed to be to reestablish and recreate the crumbling infrastructure, not to build new boondoggles.
Larry, go ahead.
I was just going to observe, I think Chris is right that it would be silly not to fix things that are broken that we use all the time right now and for which there are safety concerns. There are quite a few structurally deficient bridges across the state. But you know, the East-West Rail, maybe the name is its own worst enemy here. There really is a housing problem and commuting problem for the part of the state where most people live. And if better service could allow you to live in Worcester County and work in Boston, that is, I think, the most convincing argument for economic development and the welfare of the state's economy. If people can hop into Boston on a reasonable commute and live in an area where they can buy and own a home, I think that's really positive. I would love to see a train come to Pittsfield, but if that had to be pared out of the project, the last section through Hampden County and Berkshire County is really tricky. It's steep and narrow and would need a lot of that investment. And for the ridership, it probably wouldn't pay. But I think in the Boston, greater Boston, Worcester area, it would be a huge change. And since this money only comes once in a while, why not use it for something that would really change the playing field?
This is not money that comes once in a while. This is a huge chunk of money. It's, I think, over $4 billion out of the almost $13 billion that Massachusetts would receive. So that money is not going to come around again. And that's why I have a different opinion than Chris. Yes, money has been misspent a million times in Massachusetts, but a west to east rail line, sorry Pittsfield, but at least from Springfield to Boston, would stimulate the economy a lot in Western Massachusetts, and hopefully would be built and managed in a way that people would use it frequently.
Chris, do you have a rebuttal?
One of the big problems with the Knowledge Corridor trains is that it's not affordable. I mean, to take a train from Greenfield to New York, I think it's like almost $200. I mean, if you're going to build an East-West rail, fine. If you think it's going to be an economic game changer, fine. But there's got to be a way to ensure that lower income people can afford to use it. Otherwise, you know, you're building a train for what? For, you know, to go to a Red Sox game, you know, once in a while. I mean, if you want, one of the reasons the T works in Boston is because it's affordable and it goes everywhere. If you're talking about just a commuter rail from Worcester to Boston, that's one thing. I don't see a cross-state East-West rail line being profitable or as user-friendly. And if they can find a way to make it be that way, that's great.
Still to come on And Another Things Friday Week in Review, the Springfield Police Department is again under scrutiny, and the future of big-time football at UMass. You're listening to And Another Things Friday Review of the Week's News. Derek Kennedy is off today. I'm Maya Schwader. This week in Springfield, a jury delivered its first verdict in the criminal cases brought against 14 Springfield police officers. Back in 2015, several off-duty police officers got in a fight with four other men at a bar, and then they were accused of trying to cover it up. The officers were white, the men from the bar were black. Officer Darren Wynn was one of the officers who responded to the disturbance. He was charged with perjury, misleading police investigators, and filing a false police report for not revealing that the people involved in the fight at Nathan Bill's bar were off-duty officers. Jurors found Wynn not guilty this week, but the trial included some testimony that certainly did not paint the police officers in a favorable light. One witness described eight officers attacking four black men and beating them quite aggressively. Now, the Springfield police have had a testy relationship with their city. In fact, the ACLU of Massachusetts has in the past described the department as, quote, one of the worst police departments in the country. This recent case, even with an officer being found not guilty, how much does this hurt police efforts to improve their image among the citizens of Springfield? Natalia, do you want to go first?
Well, one thing is that it proves that justice is really relies on clever lawyers, not on what has really happened. And so what does this say about the Springfield Police Department? What it usually says about the Springfield Police Department, that there are some rogue officers there, and if they, when they're off duty, they misbehave.
Chris, your thoughts?
Yeah, I have to agree with Natalia. I think when you wear a badge, it's not just something you take off at the end of the day and then you can do whatever the hell you want. You're supposed to be there to protect and to serve. You're supposed to exist in a higher standard. And I think that the good cops that are out there see this kind of thing and they get really ticked off because it allows for what's been happening a lot in this country, which is to paint all police as racist, to paint them all as corrupt or thugs or the first person to go for a gun or a bat. And it's not a fair characterization. But historically, this has not been a good time for the Springfield Police Department in terms of reputation and in terms of incidents like this, and this doesn't help. Perception is reality when you talk about cases like this, and I think that the perception of the Springfield Police has not been good for a long time. Now, you can talk to the blue in the face about reforms and finding ways to reform, and you know you can threaten defunding. But I think that, you know, until you have citizens more involved in the operation of a department like that, and until you have more oversight, it's not just, you know, in name only, but actual oversight, you're going to have situations like this. And Natalia is right. You know, sometimes people misbehave, but there needs to be a recognition in that department, inside the department, that when you put that badge on, it doesn't come off at the end of your shift, that you have a responsibility to protect and serve your community 24/7. And that doesn't seem to be happening a lot.
You're listening to the Friday Week in Review here on And Another Thing. Our panelists today are Holyoke Media News Director Natalia Munoz, Berkshire Eagle Investigations Editor Larry Parnas, and FranklinCounty.com Contributing Editor Chris Collins. One of the highest paid Massachusetts state employees is now out of a job. Walt Bell, who is the now former head football coach at University of Massachusetts, has been handed his walking papers. He had only two wins under his belt in his 3 years at the helm. But it is a bit of a surprise that UMass athletic director Ryan Bamford fired Bell with three games still left in the season.
As much as I appreciate and feel like Walt did a number of things that we asked him to do, we've got to develop and we've got to be competitive and we've got to win games.
UMass will still have to pay Bell two-thirds of his $625,000 annual salary over the next 2 years. We should note that UMass's losing streak is a legacy from before Bell's time, the 9 seasons that the team has had since moving to the top NCAA division. It has not had a winning season. All right, this begs the question. Can anyone lead UMass to a victory?
Maybe we could pick up Bear Bryant. Maybe he'd be available.
I think Chris has the answer for sure on that one.
Look, I understand that if there's a lot of consternation about the move up to a higher division and UMass football, it's terrible. But you know what? It wasn't that long ago we were saying the same thing about the UMass hockey program, which just won a national championship. But it took 20 years and I don't know how many coaches for that to come back around. So it can come back around, but what's crucial is you have to get the right coach, you have to be playing in the right division, and you have to be able to recruit. Those are the three big things. I think they're in the wrong division. And, you know, eventually, you know, you'll get a John Calipari type coach, some kind of coach that will come in and turn that program around. But for now, it's not a pretty situation, and it comes down to money. I mean, it's all about whether or not this program makes money for the university, just like the basketball programs do. And they'll find somebody that can come in and right that ship at some point, but it may take a few years to do it.
What if they were to move down a division, though? Why do they need to be in the top NCAA division?
Money. It's a cash game. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. College sports is big money. It brings in money for the university, for the endowments, for all kinds of things. And that's why they moved up. That, you know, they figured, well, they could fill Gillette Stadium and they could have a bigger crowd. They could appeal to the Boston area and get more donors. It all comes down to money. But if you don't win, you're not going to make any money.
Well, this begs the question. I mean, I realize I'm in the United States of America, and this might be a controversial thing to ask, but does UMass need football? What if there were no football program?
It wouldn't break my heart. I've never been to a game, so I can't tell you.
Natalia, do you have thoughts?
Yeah, it wouldn't break my heart either.
I think the lacrosse program is more popular than the football program is at this point. Of course, lacrosse doesn't have tailgating like football does.
That is it for this week. Thank you so much to our panel. We had FrankshireCounty.com contributing editor Chris Collins, Berkshire Eagle Investigations editor Larry Parnas, and Holyoke Media News director Natalia Munoz. Thank you, as always, for joining us. And at the end of the week, a reminder that you can catch up on any of our previous programs by visiting our webpage at nepm.org. And you can follow us on social media. We are at AAT on NEPM across all platforms. I'm Maya Schwader. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.